advanced information economies. But popular culture is also rooted in the demands and directions of social communication, in the social practices of consumption by which popular value and popular sentiment are generated and organized. The foundation of contemporary popular culture is that lived social experience of people in everyday life from which producers, as a matter of fact, Todd Gitlin makes quite a point of this in his article on television and popular culture hegemony, producers drawing from cultural commodities their models, their materials, in fact, their energy. Popular culture as consumer culture is, of course, a hegemonic vehicle which ties people to certain existing dominant definitions of social order and political order and economic order. And it is also, at the same time, the manner in which those materials are appropriated in consumption. That is, what popular culture means depends upon the conditions by which individuals and groups appropriate, that is, render concrete and relevant and meaningful the works of popular culture. The conclusion to be drawn from the framework of popular culture is the untenability of an adversarial rather than a kind of dialectical approach to the relationship of economic and cultural process, particularly in popular music, a relationship that's marked by shifting confrontations and accommodations and tensions in culture, in commerce, in technologies, in the whole history of the social process of popular culture. Now, this question of technology complicates the issue considerably, particularly when we get to popular music. A crucial variable, in fact, in the analysis of popular culture of music is the principle of technology. That popular culture has become increasingly elaborated and is encountered in a technological order that tends to punctuate the innovation and dissemination of new musical goods. The contentious issue here, of course, is the level of technological domination and technological dependency, kind of alienation, which is based on this swift pace and turnover of goods and the spectacles of popular culture. The question of technology in popular music points to these rather divergent views in looking at the role of technology in popular culture in a broader sense. Interpretations range from Simon Fritz's argument that innovation in the oligopoly of the popular music industry is possible only because technological changes open gaps in existing market control to some of the postmodern pronouncements that Will referred to, particularly in the literature on rock video. Rock video is a type of popular culture which works in the language of violence and seduction and so on, pornography. But there has to be a specificity to looking at technology in cultural process. Technologies of production and reproduction in popular music, from the print medium of broadside ballads, for example, to the initial capturing and reproduction of sound on Edison cylinder, the tinfoil diaphragm and needle phonograph device, to the disc, the record disc as we know it, to magnetic tape, to digital recording and compact disc reproduction, all have always had a profound impact on the very concept of musical pleasure and musical consumption. These technologies, however, must be specified historically within social and economic conditions that situate and define them, and they define them as either alienating, as fracturing, or as emancipating, or as incorporating, or a multitude of other effects and functions that complicate the technology question, and in particular, technological innovation in cultural production. Technology mystifies. That's part of it. Technology certainly does do that, but understanding the specificity of innovation serves to concrete the nature and implications of particular technological forms. Technology is a condition of popular culture, and as such demonstrates both dominating and emancipatory tendencies, containment and resistance within its forms. Media of music distribution are a very interesting case, that from early sheet music to the jukebox, the record disc, radio, film, television, cassette tapes, music video, compact discs, and numerous other forms are techniques through which both dependence and innovation have occurred, through which trends and tastes and consumption patterns have been manufactured, and at the same time, they also constitute the means by which assaults on the conventions and prohibitions and control of the music industry have been carried out. There is a question of historical continuity here that's quite important. I believe that questions of contemporary technology and cultural production have to be, of course, understood through all kinds of various historical examples through which social process of popular culture can be understood as continuity. 20th century popular music has been created and transformed, certainly, in mechanical elaborations and commercial orders, yet the continuity of the process of popular music as popular culture and its relationship to media of production and distribution can be perceived in various historical moments. The most intriguing example, one of my favorites, is the strikingly modern enterprise, and consumption of the broadside ballad. These broadside ballads were black letter street ballads that were produced in mass printings and illustrated by woodcut on large folio sheets from the mid-16th century to the early 20th century. Canada, in particular Newfoundland, was one place where the broadside tradition was quite vital up until the almost the mid-20th century. In particular, the bard of Prescott Street, Johnny Burke, who wrote and produced, mass-produced ballads about life in St. John's from before the turn of the century to well into the 20th century. These ballads served as a kind of combined soap operas and scandal, tabloids and murder mysteries and romance fictions and so on, and they were the collaborative product of the commercial enterprise of printing companies and the lyrical and musical skills and strategies of commercial hack writers like A.M. Tunesmiths. These were broadside ballad makers. So that broadsides were disseminated through a variety of means, usually cheap stalls, stationer's stalls on the streets, door-to-door peddlers, though the most important marketing vehicle was the performer, the hawker, the street screamer of these ballads. Probably the most interesting aspect of this example is that these itinerant singers would report back to the print shop on the trends and tendencies and directions in audience taste and demand. And the production of new broadsides and the size of particular runoffs of a particular ballad would be determined accordingly. Now, most significant is the example, is the nature of broadside consumption. These ballads moved consistently from print to oral tradition and back again. They became, through transformations, a popular music culture that was reliant upon, derived from, and structured in the complex relations between commerce, technology, and culture. Clearly, the differences between the pervasiveness and the elaboration of contemporary information order technology and the pre-industrial and early industrial, pre-capitalist and early capitalist technologies present widely divergent economic and social universes. The continuity, however, is there. The continuity is evident in the broader popular culture process, that is, in the socially active practices and contexts of consumption. and the service and strategy of technology in always serving or attempting to order consumption, to make consumption orderly. And in music, in this particular case, as symbolic expressive resource in social systems of meaning, and in projects in the other direction to impose forms of commercially inspired containment on those systems. Technology is actively used by all those constituents in these relationships and will serve variously containment and resistance interests in the changing historical conditions of production and consumption of popular music. Popular music has always involved appropriation. It's always involved borrowing and incorporating and plundering and colonizing of local, limited, and lived culture, lived social experience and cultural practice by commercial strategies of production. The emergence of rock and roll, for example, involved the appropriation of numerous and very regional and idiomatic musical styles and musical traditions, and the energy and the emotion from a history of racial and cultural tensions. Further, the business of rock and roll at its inception borrowed as much from the production and distribution conventions of its immediate precursor, which was rhythm and blues, as it did from rhythm and blues vocal and instrumental styles. In particular, small-scale entrepreneurship of these maverick independent record labels that developed in response to the demands of the black market after the Second World War, and to the void created when major record companies abandoned this race market, established an approach to marketing that defied previous conventions of an industry that was dominated by major record companies before the war. This approach and the role of local street conscious independence became the basis for the business of early rock and roll. It was local audience activity and a consumer demand that was not quite tapped that acted as an impetus for independent labels to produce records for those musical outlets that were most immediately serving this local activity. In other words, those musical outlets that responded to audiences in the most immediate way, jukeboxes, radio stations, and record stores. So with lessons of production and lessons of distribution learned through this market, the rhythm and blues market, the independent companies followed the emergence of rock and roll with a very keen sense of audience and of locale, local culture. Now, there is particular relevance for this example that I've given to the Canadian context, and I'll demonstrate that briefly. In the Canadian perspective, these processes of popular music production are situated in a struggle between a dominant culture of centralization, central Canadian and U.S. commerce, and the popular culture of region. And here I'm employing the first use of popular culture that I talked about. From the case of popular music in Canada, this struggle can be understood largely in terms of the U.S.-based oligopoly of popular music production, of promotion and distribution industries, and the cultural practices of music making and consumption, and the independent industries of production, promotion, and distribution that exist on the local level and local music scenes throughout this country. The CRTC, okay, Canadian regulatory body, implemented the Broadcasting Act requirement that Canadian broadcasters provide quality programming of predominantly Canadian resources by regulations of Canadian content. AM radio, for example, is bound by a 30% Canadian content rule between the hours of 6 a.m. and midnight, and while the percentage for FM varies according to the type of music played, popular music stations must comply with the same 30% requirement. The two basic premises have provided significant directions for broadcasting policy that addresses Canadian sound recording. First, a recognition that the future of the Canadian popular music industry lies in the hands of Canadian-owned independent record labels and depends on the ability of these labels to tap and to nurture Canadian musical resources in various centers across the country. And second, there is a recognition that the sound recording industry in Canada is crucial to the country in both economic and cultural terms. I will not bore you with statistics, but essentially, very briefly, I'll just state that the recording and recording-related industries in Canada generate a retail sales of over $6 million each year and responsible for directing another $1 billion economy of revenues generated from various things like live concert performances, manufacturing, music publishing, record studios, packaging, promotion, merchandising, and so on and so on. Okay. So there's a recognition that there are these two areas that are quite critical, and yet there are fundamental problems in both the economic and cultural realms. The economic status of Canadian record companies is questionable at present. Currently, almost half of these Canadian companies, independent Canadian companies, are showing incredible losses. They're not doing a thriving business. And it is not simply the soaring production costs and marketing costs that account for financial problems. Independent record companies and Canadian-owned companies are particularly susceptible here, have been traditionally marginal enterprises, dominated by a multinational industry of popular culture production. And these multinationals, of course, are typically US-based, that hold financial control in other entertainment media and media technology, film and television production in particular, and in the production of consumer goods that are generally youth-directed, tied in critically to popular music. Independent Canadian labels simply cannot survive in a situation of competition with those companies that have the means to eliminate risk of revenue returns for musical products through strategies of overproduction and through promotional tie-ins with other products. The problems then in the industry can be summed up very quickly. It's over-directed. The industry here is over-directed to the production of records, and it's unprepared to deal with the changing patterns in musical consumption, and in particular with the elaboration of other musical technologies, media technologies. The Canadian content requirement is directly tied to the availability of sufficient quantities of Canadian records, in that all stations now must comply with that regulation. However, the centralization in both industries of musical production, together with the decline of production of Canadian music, has seriously limited the quantities of those. It's a kind of a catch-22. They're just simply not the materials generated to sustain the industry, and certainly to sustain and to respond in some responsible manner, that is, to a regulation of this sort. The bottom line here, and the point to be made to draw these issues together, is an understanding of popular culture as local culture, particularly in the Canadian perspective. The best initiatives on parts of both government and private sector to instill money and direction into this industry have failed to fully understand and to recognize the vitality and promise of local music activities, artists, producers, audiences, in both commercial and cultural terms, something that I might add is only seen or is best seen by certain university radio stations. Sun and Fraser is one example here. So to conclude, popular culture itself and popular culture of music especially, the goods of popular culture are reproduced as subjective, as social, as symbolic forms of expressive culture, and popular culture, popular music in particular, offers the raw materials of that type of production at the popular culture at that level. It certainly is the question of the production of popular music in Canada is one case through which the issues of commerce, culture, and technology, particularly in mass communication studies, can be